Good morning, brethren, friends of the truth. I want to thank everyone that came to me yesterday after my first class and offered lots of insightful points to consider regarding Daniel. A couple of which were brought to my attention I want to share with you all today before we get into my actual notes for today's You know, many of you that listened yesterday commented upon the four-square encampment aspect that I brought forward or introduced to you, and especially the placement of Daniel's three friends, you know, along the borders of the encampment of Israel. Well, we're not going to take time to go through chapter 3 of Daniel, but we are familiar with that chapter, especially from growing up in if you're growing up as a Christadelphian, studied the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being thrown into the fiery furnace. But if you would, just turn over to Daniel 3, verse 25. We'll read that real quick. In Daniel 3, 25, we notice, you know, first of all, in Daniel chapter 3, in this situation, Daniel's not involved with this predicament. This is dealing with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So, verse 25 says this, "Look," he answered, "I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." So here we have a fourth individual identified as the Son of God. And as we understand, this was an angel of Yahweh, or one of the Elohim, or a mighty one of El. So it keeps within our minds that these four men still represented that mind of Yahweh, or what would be making up the future day, the multitudinous Christ. What I'd like to do is read a brief excerpt out of this, out of the Daniel Expositor, page 89. Says, "Though Yahweh had not delivered his servants from the fire, he had delivered them in it. He had deliberately suspended his natural laws and arrested the normal procedure of nature. What he did then, he will do again in the future. He will deliver his people from out of the fiery time of trouble that shall involve all nations and grant them eternal life in the kingdom. His own people of Israel will be raised from the political death which has claimed them, and they shall experience a political resurrection and glorification in the kingdom." Now, that wasn't really the point that was brought forward to me, but it kind of fits in. Well, another application would be to continue this thought that we brought forward yesterday. When you look at chapter 2, verse 49, where we see Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. It will be the occupation of the Christ body to destroy the beast system, which is centered in the papal institutions in Europe. And will not this be a fiery trial for all those upon the earth of that day? And of course, the Christ body, under the divine control of the Son of God, will be afforded complete protection from that situation. And consider the observation that is made by those of the world in verse 27. Back in chapter 3, 27, that is. "And the satraps, the administrators, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose body the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them." So, you know, the redeemed will not take on any of the attributes of this Babylonian system when they defeat this Babylonian system in the age to come. Another comment that was brought to my attention was quite interesting, I think, and we're not going to, which I think you ought to look into on your own time. As we made the comparison between Daniel, John, and Christ as all being termed the beloved. Well, open your Bibles to 1 John chapter 3, verse 2. First John 3, 2 says, "Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when He is revealed, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is." So here we see, brethren, we're termed the beloved. So we make up, that multitudinous body in the age to come. And I would, if I did my count correct, if you go through the epistles of John, you'll find that he references the body or the brethren there, beloved, on 8 occurrences or 8 times. And 8 speaks to the number of immortality, that cutting off of the flesh. So something you should look into on your own. Now this morning, we'd like to consider the tree dream in Daniel chapter 4. We're at Daniel here is at an age of approximately 52 years old. If we go to chapter 4, look at verse 37. This is pretty much the summary of what the point of this chapter. And, if you go through the Daniel Expositor by Mansfield, he brings out that every chapter brings out an aspect of judgment on something. And in this case, chapter 4 is the judgment of human pride. So 4:37 says, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride, he is able to abase." Speaking of Yahweh, the God of Daniel, he is able to abase those that walk in pride. So the fourth chapter of Daniel records the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, its interpretation by Daniel, and the record of its historical fulfillment. The symbols which are provided in this chapter build upon the things revealed to Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel from the previous dream of the great image of dissimilar or diverse metals, of which we know Babylon was interpreted as being the head. But in this dream, an enormous tree provided insight to the future events that would affect this nation of Babylon and the succeeding nations that comprise the kingdom of men, and even things dealing directly with the man Nebuchadnezzar himself. In general, this vision's purpose was to transform a man of pride and self-esteem to one that recognizes that the Most High does rule in the kingdom of men. Now, as Daniel continued to serve in the courts of Babylon, he did not let opportunities slip by to profess the magnificence of Yahweh's power to this appointed king. It is evident that by the time Nebuchadnezzar recounted this vision of the tree dream, Daniel, had witnessed the truth to Nebuchadnezzar on several occasions. Let's go back to chapter 2, verse 28. Chapter 2, 28 says, get this thing working. There we go. Speaking about Yahweh being an all-wise God, he says, "But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these." So we key in on the first part of that. There is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets, showing the all-wise aspect of Yahweh. We see in chapter 3, verses 28 and 29, that he was shown the powerfulness of Yahweh. It says there in verse 28, "Then Nebuchadnezzar spake, and he said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other god that can deliver after this sort." So, you know, here's Nebuchadnezzar. He recognized this power. He also recognized or was taught that Yahweh is supreme. In Daniel 4, verses 34 through 35. Here we see, "And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High. And I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, What doest thou?" So, basically, he was taught that Yahweh's kingdom would excel beyond that of Babylon. He was taught about the supremacy of Yahweh. Look at Daniel 2:44. "And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." Now, although this elementary principle of Yahweh's dominance over Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar remained a headstrong and a prideful man. So immediately after the tree dream was told, Daniel pleaded with Nebuchadnezzar to break off thy sins. Look at verse 27 of chapter 4. He says, "Break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor." But we know that the pleadings were in vain, and soon Nebuchadnezzar allowed the pride of life to manifest itself. We see in Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, look what he says. "The king spake and said, Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" And we see that this was the case. If you go over to chapter 5, and we see, speaking of Nebuchadnezzar, verse 18 shows us that it's in reference to Nebuchadnezzar. Then you go on down to verse 20 and notice what it says. "But when his heart," that's when Nebuchadnezzar's heart, "was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him." This attitude and self-centered character, which was manifested in Nebuchadnezzar, has been common to all, or many, I would say, probably all rulers, authorities, kings, emperors, dignitaries of the kingdom of men. To correct this disposition was and is the whole purpose of this tree dream to Nebuchadnezzar. You know, in this, we're not going to read the account, but if you start around verse 11 in chapter 4, you know, what we have recorded is a tree of magnificent height, that the leaves thereof were fair, the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all the flesh was fed of it. Yet the tree did not abide forever, and we see that an angelic host or an angelic watcher comes in to play and hews down this great tree. No longer were the beasts able to abide under it, nor could the birds take lodge in the branches. The stump and its roots of this great tree were to remain in the earth, to be bound with a band of iron and brass. But really, this was not the end of the dream. It's not just about a tree becoming a banded stump. The dream turns now to a personal aspect, directly to Nebuchadnezzar. It depicts Nebuchadnezzar as being placed outside the comforts of his majestic palace, wandering in the wet dew, and feeding upon the grass as a beast of the field. Now, this wasn't an overnight camping trip that he was to take outside the walls of Babylon. This was to be a 7-year humbling of the most powerful man which ruled in the kingdom of men. The entire dream then had a motive, a lesson, a purpose, which is revealed to us in verse 17. Verse 17 says, "To the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men." Nebuchadnezzar was bent on understanding the dream. And in verse 18, he says to Daniel, "This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof, for as much as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in thee." Now it's kind of interesting here. Now we're introduced to Daniel as being named Belteshazzar, which we didn't really go into yesterday because I guess I wanted us to concentrate more upon the names really given to these men, you know, Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, so forth, because the Hebrew names provide, of course, insight to the character of those men. Here, of course, this was a Babylonian name given to Daniel, and I don't believe he probably appreciated this name because it means keeper of the secrets of Bel, you know, Bel being a pagan god that was worshipped at that time. And if you go through and you look at all the occurrences of this name within the book of Daniel, you'll find that It's written nine times within the book, okay? Which then just again jumps right out at us, you know, nine being the number of judgment. It's used in six occurrences or six occasions. So there again, you have this number of man being brought right out, that number of the flesh, that which shall be destroyed. So I don't believe Daniel really appreciated this name, Belteshazzar, but of course Nebuchadnezzar used it in some occasions. So Daniel, due to his faith, his belief, and his knowledge of Yahweh's plan, quickly came to an understanding of what this dream was to mean. But we notice in verse 19, he was hesitant to reveal the message to Nebuchadnezzar. Let me read that. He says, "Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. So the king spake and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies." Now, approximately 20 years earlier, Ezekiel had prophesied against Egypt and used the symbol of the lofty cedar tree to represent the Assyrian monarchy. Daniel likely would have been familiar with this prophecy or these words, which would have allowed him to comprehend the meaning of Nebuchadnezzar's tree dream. Let's go to Ezekiel 31, verses 3 through 6. Here we read Ezekiel 31, verse 3, "Behold, the Assyrian was a cedar in Lebanon, with fair branches and with a shadowing shroud and of a high stature, and his top was among the thick boughs. The waters made him great, the deep set him up on high, with her rivers running around about his plants, and sent out her little rivers unto all the trees of the field. Therefore his height was exalted above all the trees of the field, and his boughs were multiplied, and his branches became long because of the multitude of waters when he shot forth. All the fowls of heaven made their nest in his boughs, and under his branches did all the beasts of the field bring forth their young, and under his shadow dwelt all great nations." Quite interesting. This makes us think right back to what we've read back in chapter 4 of Daniel. In these verses, we see that Assyria illustrated as a mighty cedar tree similar to the great tree of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, under which all the surrounding nations took refuge and protection. But the hand of Yahweh saw fit to abase the Assyrians because of their pride. Look at Ezekiel 31, verses 10 through 11. It says there, "Therefore thus saith the Lord God, because thou hast lifted up thyself in height, and hath shot up his top among the thick boughs, and his heart is lifted up in his height, I have therefore delivered him into the hand of the mighty one of the heathen. He shall surely deal with him. I have driven him out for his wickedness." So this prophecy was provided to Pharaoh in Egypt that he too might learn from the example of others. So, you know, that's what we do, brethren. We have to learn from the example of others. Human arrogance and pride leads to the corrective hand of Yahweh. Human arrogance and pride leads to the corrective hand of Yahweh. For those nations that look to elevate their own selves and do not put their trust in Yahweh, he shall abase them. And as in the case of Assyria, he would never allow their nation to return to their former greatness. The same application is to be applied to the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's tree dream. His kingdom and his personal authority was likened to a mighty and lofty tree. A tree that provided lodging and protection for the beasts of the field and fowl of the air. The beasts and the fowls in this dream represent the nations, the dignitaries that found support and protection from the Babylonian Empire, all being subject to or under the influence of great King Nebuchadnezzar. Such prominence was prophesied earlier to Nebuchadnezzar in his interpretation of the image dream. So go back to Daniel 2, verse 37 through 38. Daniel 2, 37 through 38. O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given unto thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all, thou art this head of gold. The use of beasts to represent the subordinate nations of Nebuchadnezzar was also prophesied by Jeremiah. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 27. Jeremiah 27, verses 6. Right. "And now have I given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. And the beasts of the field have I given him also to serve him. and all the nations shall serve him and his son's son until the time of his, until the very time of his land come, and then many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of him. And it shall come to pass that the nation and the kingdom which will not serve the same Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and that will not put their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, that nation will I punish, saith Yahweh, with the sword and with the famine and with the pestilence, until I have consumed them by his hand. So we note there in verse 6 that the beasts of the field were under the service to Nebuchadnezzar. All the nations were to serve him. The prophecy of the handwriting on the wall to Belshazzar, which is documented by Daniel, offers even further proof that the prophetic word fulfilled before the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar is correct. That is, that he saw that these beast nations were to be subordinate to him as dictated by Yahweh. So now jump over to Daniel chapter 5. Daniel 5, verse 18. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, a kingdom and a majesty and glory and honor, and for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would he slew, whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. But you see verse 19, the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. And for another example, consider the night vision of Daniel chapter 7, in which four diverse beasts rose from this great sea. The scriptures provide the following interpretation to the prophet Daniel in verse 17. It says, these great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. So we see then, beasts are definitely a description of the kings of the earth. There's no question in our minds to that. The scriptures speak specifically to it. So when we go back then to the tree dream to Nebuchadnezzar, we find that he was to have his kingdom exalted with all nations in obeisance unto him until this watcher, this holy one, should come down from heaven and hew down this great tree. Who then is this holy watcher? Well, the Hebrew for this word watcher denotes that it's an angel. Yet the root word indicates the aspect of the opening of the eyes, or the awakening, to awake, or even one who is vigilant. This watcher describes the duties and the responsibilities of the angelic hosts, angels which are provided as ministering spirits, keeping a watchful eye upon the believers and the course of the nations and their leaders throughout time. Go to Proverbs 15, verse 3. Proverbs 15, verse 3. The eyes of Yahweh are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. And in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 13. Speaking of the duties of the angelic host, we read this. But to which of the angels said he at any time, sit on my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool? Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation? So in the tree dream prophecy, the angelic watcher is limiting the influence and the power of Nebuchadnezzar and his Babylonian kingdom. This principle is expressed by the chopping down of this magnificent tree. This restrictive hand of Yahweh, as executed by his angels, was a concept that was well understood by the Apostle Paul. Consider the words which he addressed to the men of Athens on Mars Hill in Acts 17, verse 26. Acts 17, verse 26. He says, "And hath made one blood of all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation." So we see these things are in the control of the hand of Yahweh, and he affects this through the workers that is his angelic host. So although Yahweh had pre-appointed the time or the duration of the Babylonian kingdom, he still allowed remnants of this tree to remain in the earth. The stump was left, and then it was banded with iron and brass. We see in chapter 4, verse 15, record of this. Go back and read that. It says, "And I saw in the visions on my head, nevertheless, leave the stump and its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and brass, and the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth." Yahweh in these symbols teach us that the pagan and religious teachings that found root or origination in Babylon would continue to influence those that dwell upon the earth long after the political demise of this Babylonian empire. These teachings, these rituals, false doctrines, of course, brethren, we know would eventually creep into the true ecclesia. And we know also that these became adopted by the rulers and the common people of the Roman and the Grecian empires, thus answering to the band of iron and brass protecting this tree stump left in the earth. Earlier in Nebuchadnezzar's first dream, he was introduced to these elements of brass and iron, which were to be interpreted to be, by Daniel, a third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. For as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these, it shall break in pieces and bruise. Years later, Daniel would also see again these elements of brass and iron brought forward in vision, when he was given the vision of the four beasts, specifically in the fourth beast, in Daniel 7, verse 19. 7:19 says, "Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet." It is interesting to note that history supports the interpretations of these dreams. The centers of the influence on Christianity can be traced through the cities of Rome and Constantinople all the way back to Babylon. We know that when the Ottoman Turks occupied Constantinople in 1453, which was then a Grecian city, the headquarters of the Greek Catholic Church, they extended their religious influence throughout Macedonia and further south. Constantinople was changed into an Islamic center, and the Greek Orthodox churches were converted into mosques. The headquarters of the Greek Catholic Church was driven from Constantinople and set up in Moscow, which today we think of as the Third Rome. But here's the thing. Greek Catholicism, along with Roman Catholicism, remained as a band of brass and iron around this Babylonian stock and root. The pagan teachings of Babylon, of Babylonian worship, have been superimposed upon Christianity starting in the days of Constantine, and were openly incorporated into the theology of both the Roman Catholic and Greek Catholic churches. And brethren, these things remain to this day in popular and modern Christianity. We note that the dream now moves to a personal application to Nebuchadnezzar, as it begins using the third personal singular pronouns him and his in verses 15 and 16. There it says, let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of an animal, and let seven times pass over him. The proclamation was that Nebuchadnezzar would undergo a change of heart. But first, he would be driven from his position of authority and caused to roam with the beasts of the field for a period of 7 years. The condition which was to overcome Nebuchadnezzar would today be diagnosed as lycanthropy. I'm not sure if I pronounced it correctly, but lycanthropy, which basically is a mental illness where one believes that he or she has transformed into an animal and behaves accordingly. One believes that they have transformed into an animal and they behave accordingly. The whole purpose of driving Nebuchadnezzar out of power was to humble him before Yahweh, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, even set up over it the basis of men. Daniel, we know, had tried to warn Nebuchadnezzar about his pride, and we know from the verses considered earlier that Yahweh's preeminence over man was proclaimed to Nebuchadnezzar on two previous occasions. Yet as time passed by, 12 months after the dream was given, the king spake and said, Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by my might and by my power and for the honor of my majesty? And we know that while the word was still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. He was driven out for then a period of 7 years. This seven-year period causes us to reflect upon the seven times of trouble that was proclaimed against the Israelites for their disobedience. Go back to Leviticus chapter 26. Leviticus 26 is verses 18 through 24. Here we are told, and if ye will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins, and I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass, and your strength shall be spent in vain, and your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits. And if ye walk contrary unto me, and will not hearken unto me, I will bring seven times more plagues upon you according to your sins. I will also send wild beasts among you, which shall rob you of your children and destroy your cattle, make you few in number, and your highways shall be desolate. And if you will not be reformed by me by these things, but will walk contrary unto me, then I also will walk contrary unto you and will punish you yet seven times for your sins. You know, don't we see a lot of similar language linking us there between Daniel and here that what was proclaimed to the children of Israel? Now, a time, as seen both in the Daniel and Leviticus accounts, has been adopted by most Bible students to represent a period of one Jewish year, or 360 days. Now, the product, then, of 7 times 360 equates to 2520. So we can think about this as being a period of 2,520 years. This number of 2,520 has historical significance when we compare it to the dates of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Starting in 604 BC, we know that Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. And if we move forward in time, 2,520 years from the date of 604, we are brought to the year 1917, the year in which the Ottoman Turks were driven from Jerusalem by the British general Allenby. This period of seven times, or 2,520 of years, defines a period in history where Jerusalem was always under the authority, lordship, and control of these Gentile nations that might be summarized of having, you know, the base of brass and iron. Since 1917, the stage was set for the Jews to recapture control of the land of Israel and Jerusalem. And this period of 2,520 years is scripturally defined as the times of the Gentiles, as we see in Luke 21:24. In Luke 21:24, we read, "And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and they shall be led away captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." Now, brethren, don't mistake me here and say, well, okay, Rob thinks that the times of the Gentiles are over because the date has expired in 1917. Of course, we know that the times of the Gentiles have not expired. They're still over control. The kingdom of men still has to be taken care of by Christ and the saints, the Battle of Armageddon. But I think this, you know, we see that there are unique time periods that seem to show evidence that Yahweh does work with us and work with his people. The period of Gentile lordship is symbolized by the condition that overcame Nebuchadnezzar. Think about this. The period of the Gentile lordship is symbolized by the condition that overcame Nebuchadnezzar. He acted as a beast of the field, characterized by aggressive, self-centered, ruthless modes of living. Those ruling in the kingdom of men during this period of Gentile times have portrayed these attributes. And the prophet Jeremiah describes this condition of the nations as being mad. Look at Jeremiah 51:7. Here we are told, "Babylon hath been a golden cup in Yahweh's hand that made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad." The word mad here in Jeremiah 51 is from this Hebrew word halal. It means to make a show, to boast, and thus to be foolish, to rave, or to be mad. These, brethren, are the characteristics that define the nations who have been drunken by the Babylonian wine. Those who have adopted her pagan rituals, her false doctrines, and so forth. The seventh chapter of the Apocalypse uses these very symbols to explain this. talking about this Babylonian system. Look at Revelation chapter 17, verses 1 through 5. And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet-covered beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns, and the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness, and of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. Can we not see, brethren, the direct link now between all these elements? Babylon, making one mad, like Nebuchadnezzar was when he went along with the beasts of the earth. The scriptural evidence is clear. One cannot ignore the links the Babylonian system has with drunkenness, filthiness, the abominations in which the nations of the earth participate, all of which culminate into the apostate teachings upheld by the Catholic Church and her daughters, defined today as modern-day Christianity. But don't think it's just there, brethren. It has crept into the true ecclesia. We have to be careful of this. Now, although the tree dream seems to provide a severe punishment upon Nebuchadnezzar for his arrogance and his self-esteem, we see that Yahweh is gracious to him and abides by his word. After this period of 7 years, he was reestablished in his kingdom. This reinstatement was definitely recognized by Nebuchadnezzar. So let's go back to chapter 4, verse 34 of Daniel. Daniel 4, verse 34. And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven, and among the inhabitants of the earth none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? So just as Nebuchadnezzar changed his attitude and humbled himself before Yahweh after his punishment, so will the nations in the future age that are humbled by Christ and the saints. We learn from Daniel chapter 7 that the nations that were once associated with this beast system are not completely destroyed by Christ and the saints, but they eventually submit to the authority of Christ. Look at Daniel 7, verses 11 and 12. I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I'm going to read a note I've placed in my Bible regarding this verse. At the destruction of the fourth beast by Christ, his rule from Zion will invite all nations to submit to his authority. This fourth beast system will have no power, and for 1,000 years, that is for a season and a time, their lives shall be prolonged. That is, these nations that submit to the rod of iron by Christ and the saints. The concluding words of Nebuchadnezzar give us foresight to know what shall happen to the hearts of the men in the kingdom age. Look at verses 36 and 37 of chapter 4. At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and my brightness and brightness returned unto me, And my counselors and my lord sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. First, you consider the brightness in verse 36. It's the Hebrew word zeev, and denotes cheerfulness, splendor, or countenance. Nebuchadnezzar's sanity was seen in his appearance as an external as well as internal, or a mental improvement. This again points towards the future age when the beastly mentality of the nations, characterized by wickedness, blasphemy, crime, and violence, will be suppressed and righteousness shall abound. Jeremiah speaks of this day in Jeremiah 3:17. He says, "And at that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord," or Yahweh, "and all the nations shall be gathered unto it, the name of Yahweh to Jerusalem, neither shall they walk any more after the imagination of their evil heart." So in summary, we have Nebuchadnezzar having come to a recognition of Yahweh's dominance in the affairs of men, and he extends his praise and honor unto him. May this be a lesson to each of us. Though we may not have the lavish luxuries and assets as did King Nebuchadnezzar, we have to learn from the example set before us to praise and thank Yahweh for all things that we have been provided with, never allowing the pride of our life to overcome us as did Nebuchadnezzar. We should take care that we be not amongst those that have allowed the influences of the Babylonian banded tree stump to take root in our lives, or in our spiritual lives, or in our doctrine. We have to await the advent of our Redeemer to bring an end to the Gentile rule over this earth. Until that day, may we be comforted with the words of this prophecy: "The matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men."